And happy St. Patrick's Day. Welcome to the News Roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran, and with me in the Woods Hole studio is Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Sean.
We'll also speak with Sarah Brown of the Martha's Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Deruta of the New Bedford Standard Times, Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, and Barry Stringfellow of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And of course, the plan is to go through some of the top news stories of the week from our region here. And let's start in Yarmouth, I believe, where the Board of Health is considering doing something that's happened in some, you know, mostly Metro Boston area communities, where the Board of Health is saying, let's post a grade for restaurants based on the health inspections. And you guys went out, the Cape Cod Times went out and spoke to some restaurateurs and some restaurant goers, and what'd you hear?
Well, the restaurateurs aren't happy with this. They don't see this as a good thing, and they worry. Interestingly enough, the thing that came up with the restaurateurs and with the Chamber of Commerce was the concern about an increase in competition among restaurants, which you might think is good, but I think they have a fairly congenial attitude towards each other there in Yarmouth, and kind of all boats floating sort of idea with restaurants doing well. As you said, this has been done elsewhere in Boston. They post the grades for the restaurants that the health department comes up with. In Barnstable, it's been done, but they post them online versus kind of at the restaurants themselves. And I think the other place that was mentioned in the story is Newton, where it's been done as well. In Barnstable, just as an example, they say that since they started doing this, they've seen an improvement. I think it was 2007 when they started doing it. They've seen an improvement in the grades. So they say it's a good thing. It's led to improved basically sanitary conditions in the restaurants and things of that nature. But again, the restaurateurs and the Chamber of Commerce say, well, what happens on a busy weekend? You don't fill that soap container that you're supposed to fill, and you get dinged for that, even though it's kind of a busy weekend and you just didn't get around to it. And that could reflect badly. It could affect your restaurant's ability to do business. And for new restaurants, they say as they get up and running, basically, and they're trying to figure out all the things that they need to do, that they may have some problems with this. As you said, reporter Madeline List went out and spoke to some folks who were going to a local restaurant, and they all seemed to say, this is a good thing. We want more information. We want to know if the restaurant's doing well. And a restaurant could hold this up and say, hey, look, we got an A. We're someplace where you can feel safe and going. And the grades, by the way, would be A through C, and based on a 100-point scale. And if you get lower than, I think, 65, you basically have to be reinspected and you have to go through the process again. So it's not as if there'd be a big letter F on a restaurant, so to speak. You'd get to C, but then below that, they'd have to take some steps to rectify the situation more thoroughly.
And it sounds like health officials were a little surprised by the reaction, because I think their rationale was grades are pretty high. I mean, most restaurants in the town would have a very high grade.
That's what they did say. And the counter to that is, of course, well, if grades are high, why do you need to do this? If everybody's doing so well, what's the problem? So, again, there's a lot of back and forth. The Board of Health still has to take this up. This is basically a staff recommendation, I think. And the board is scheduled to vote on the regulation on Monday, actually, March 20th. But there is this back and forth of it needs to be done to show that we're doing well, or it needs to be done to show where some of the gaps are.
Well, maybe health officials were surprised, but I can tell you who wasn't surprised, and that would be journalists who have for years have gone and sought that data and actually distributed it. And it's one of the things that really upsets the business community the most when you go and look at those inspection reports and then put them out there in the newspaper for people to look at. That generates calls.
And I remember when Barnstable went through this, it was a big deal at that point that they were doing it, and they're just putting it online, and that's what we were doing at the time. The Cape Cod Times and other organizations, I'm sure, were going to that online thing and looking at which restaurants passed and which restaurants didn't pass. And as you said, there was a lot of pushback and a lot of concern about that information getting out there.
Let's move on to another story. This is out of Kituit, where some residents were pretty surprised to find that there was land clearing and work going on in an area owned by the water district. It was a property owned by the water district there. And then they learned that there's a big solar farm planned for that space. Why don't you tell us about this?
Yes, and this is land that's off of Main Street and Sampson's Mill Road in Kootuat. It's Kootuat Water Department property. And the Water Department has been going forward with this plan to put up a 5.7 megawatt solar project. I think it's in two different solar arrays that they're putting it up. And it had been going along, and there had been quite a number of meetings, and the developer of the project and the water department point this out. They say there's been 20 meetings on this, and they've gone to town council, and they've gone to the planning board. So it hasn't not been known. But what happened recently was basically the water district residents, the people who live in the water district and vote for the, you know, in the fire district there, which is actually controls the water department, said, you never brought this to us, because they have their own separate meeting system. And as anybody who knows Cape Cod, there's water districts, there's fire districts, there's all these different groups that have basically almost a town meeting structure to them, separate from the towns themselves. And they said, you never actually brought this to us. And what happened recently is there was some digging and some preparation that occurred. And it actually occurred closer to neighbors than it was supposed to, according to the plan. And I think that actually gave them something to grab onto and say, look, this was a mistake that was made. And by the way, when that mistake was made, it only then came to the awareness of people in the neighborhood that you were doing it, because otherwise it would have been more isolated within the woods if they hadn't seen the clearing that had gone on closer to their properties. So in any case, I think the planning board had already approved a change that needs to happen to basically zoning for this to occur. The town council still needs to approve that, and one of the town council members who represents Kootuat points out that zoning change wasn't even brought to her, even though it's in her precinct. And she said that's kind of telling that they would bring it to another town councilor to have it done or have it recommended versus bringing it to her. And I think the allegation there is that they were trying to go around her because they knew it was going to be a problem with residents in that area, and they knew that she might be against it. And she certainly has raised a lot of concerns. There was a meeting, I believe, Wednesday night at Freedom Hall in Kootuat, and it drew a large crowd, and a lot of the residents who showed up said they were worried about what was happening, and they were also worried about the other implications here in terms of what a project on top of Water Department land could do, because the Water Department land is supposed to be there to preserve a green area and presumably preserve the water underneath it from any contamination or anything of that nature. The developer, it's Borrego Solar System, said, we're sorry for the clearing that happened. That was a mistake. They said it was an error with a GPS. Some folks weren't buying that. They said they have never had that sort of error with their own GPS systems. And they said, listen, we've gone to a lot of meetings. We're going to continue to go to meetings. We'll continue to make our case that this is a good project. But they also basically said that they've vetted this. This has been around, and they basically apologized for the error that took place.
If the project goes through, how many acres will be cleared? Was it
32 acres.
And so it sounds like this all hinges on the zoning change. In most communities in this region, that would go in front of a town meeting. Barnstable has a different structure.
It does. It's town council. There are 13 members. And again, this one member who represents Kootuat is one example of this. And they have to vote on this change. I think they're going to take it up March 23rd. This is all in a broader perspective a little bit, pretty interesting, because there's been a push away from clearing land for solar projects. And the contention is, why would you clear trees that are storing carbon in order to put in a project that is supposed to reduce the amount of carbon that you're using?
Right.
It's a somewhat circular. I think the state has even taken steps in terms of incentives to disincentivize at least the clearing of land. Usually projects have been going on landfills and other places that are kind of already cleared. I think a lot of those areas have been used up, and now folks are looking around. And the water district, the water department says, we need to do this because we lost a water tower that had cell phone service on it, and we were getting revenue from that. We've lost that revenue. We're trying to find other places to find revenue so that they can keep the bills down, is what they're saying.
So it's clearly about the money.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Sarah Brown, who's joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Gazette newsroom. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. I understand you have a story this week about an immigration arrest on the island, and that has some folks in the immigrant community pretty concerned.
Yeah, it was last Thursday that rumors were really sweeping around the island that immigration officials were here. That there was talk about raids and, you know, kind of sweeps, and we heard a lot from people, and there's also a lot of talk on social media about some kind of widespread activity on the island. And it turns out that that ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, was here to serve arrest warrants. I confirmed with them that a man in Oak Bluffs was arrested, and he had a prior DUI conviction and was previously ordered deported from the United States, so he's now in ICE custody. And Island Police said someone else was arrested in Vineyard Haven. We weren't able to confirm who that was, so it sounds like two people were arrested. But this obviously, as you said, touched off a lot of fear within the island's immigrant community and beyond. And I talked with an immigration lawyer and Island Police this week, and you know, first they said they wanted to make it clear that this, from all accounts, this wasn't a random sweep or raid at all, but that it appears that ICE came here to arrest two people, and they had warrants for those people. And from what it sounds like, at least one person had been previously ordered removed from the country. And it's not necessarily unusual for them to do that. It's happened in the past, and everyone said, you know, it's perfectly within normal activity. Though the immigration attorney I talked to said she hasn't seen ICE on the island for a while, and so she said she has seen an increase in immigration activity in the state over the last several months. But obviously, this touches on, you know, a climate where there's a lot of people in fear. There's a lot of talk right now with the new administration maybe cracking down on immigration. And Rachel Self, the immigration attorney I talked to, said she received a flurry of phone calls last Thursday from people who are really concerned, you know, asking what was happening, asking about their rights. And she said she's just really been emphasizing education for, I think, her clients, but also just the community at large, letting people know, you know, that it's not necessarily a criminal act for people to be here without legal status. And she encouraged people to reach out to, you know, nonprofit organizations and immigration lawyers to learn more about their status and to learn about their rights. And I also talked with the Edgartown Police Chief, David Rossi, who they weren't involved in any of these actions last week, but he certainly heard about it. And he said he and Island Police, and this has been coming up a lot on the island over the last few months, that they are not in the business of enforcing federal laws and immigration laws. They don't ask about status. He said he actually recently went to the school to talk to some students who were really nervous, I guess, about their parents' status, and he assured them that, you know, they shouldn't be afraid of local police, that they, you know, they assist immigration when they come if they're asked, but they're not really in the business of enforcing immigration law. They said they're not necessarily going to start doing that. So, so with some interesting conversations happening, but certainly, you know, a lot of talk and a lot of fear and some rumors going around the last week.
Let's go back to the second person who was arrested. The first person you said had previously been ordered deported, mm-hmm. and you can identify who that person was. Now, the second person, we don't know who they are.
Yeah, no. And that one, I've heard from several different people that they do believe that there are two people arrested and that one was in Vineyard Haven. Immigration wasn't able to confirm that. They need a name. I wasn't able to get a name from the Tisbury police. So it's unclear that person. It does sound like there were two people, but we're not clear what the who that was and what the arrest warrant was for. So we'll certainly follow up if we find that out.
In my view, that's the most concerning part of this story right now, is that there's a government agency that can pick up people, arrest them, and we can't find out either their names or their ages or where they were. That seems to be a real break in how police usually operate. There's a document you can go and find out.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a frustrating situation, you know, for us trying to find out more information. And also, like you said, you know, when you want to find out what the facts are, when people are really concerned, I think it's important to be able to do that. And yeah, it certainly is frustrating not to at least not quickly or easily find out that information.
Right. And it's not like they don't know the name. There's not a large number of people who were picked up and they have to figure out which one you're talking about. There's, you know, as far as we've heard, two people, and they could probably easily contact somebody in their agency and say, what's that guy's name? What's his age? And why is he being picked up, and provide that information. Instead, they in my view, hide behind this idea of we need a name to start with, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's difficult when people are being picked up in the community and you can't find out who they are. We've also in the past on this show talked about how difficult it is to find out how many people are being held in ICE detention centers. We can't get access to those detention centers. We can't get in to see what the conditions are like in those centers. So there's really kind of almost no one watching from the public.
Yeah, certainly. It's a frustrating kind of an opaque situation. Yeah.
Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thank you, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Okay. Bye-bye. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, Patrick Cassidy will still be here from the Cape Cod Times. And we'll be joined by Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me is Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times. But let's go to the phone where Tim Wood is joining us from the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom in Chatham. Hello, Tim.
Hi there, Sean.
There was some significant debate about Monomoy High School changing its graduation requirements. It sounds like they're going to no longer require a certain government class, and they're making some changes about how many classes you have to take kind of in total, right?
Sure. This it all came about as part of the school's revamping of its graduation requirements, how many credits you need to graduate. We all remember that. And along with that, a restructuring of its curriculum. The new requirement lowers the total credits needed to graduate from Monomoy High School from 100 to 94. And it makes courses in U.S. government electives rather than requirements. This became controversial because even before Monomoy, even before Chatham and Harwich regionalized the schools, both the high schools in Chatham and Harwich had very strong government programs. For years, Chatham High was the state champion in the We the People Constitutional Challenge. In Harwich, government students have for many years hosted congressional debates, conducted exit polls, all those sort of things. So those programs continued when the two schools merged at Monomoy. But school officials said having government as a requirement, part of the social studies curriculum, precluded students from taking other courses and subjects that are more closely aligned to what their post-graduation career goals might be. Because they have to take government, they may not be able to take an elective in science or math that they'd rather take to bolster what their planned study in college or after their graduation is. In addition, they said that Monomoy requires more graduation credits than some other area high schools, which they said hurt them competitively. Hmm. Now, this change will also allow the school to offer what's called a global studies diploma, which is somewhat similar but less rigorous than, say, an international baccalaureate program that Sturgis and other schools have.
Right.
Now, supporters of the change said students are taught government from kindergarten through grade 12 and that the current courses will continue. They just won't be required. And they said they expect just as many kids to be taking those courses because they've been pretty popular.
So this happens. It's starting in September?
This is starting in September, yes. It was opposed by three school committee members and a number of parents who kind of accused the school of marketing themselves by doing this rather than looking after what was good for the kids. But the school committee ended up voting for it 5-3. And as you said, Sean, it'll go into effect in the fall.
Okay, thanks for covering that. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. Patrick Cassidy is here from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, we heard from some Bourne officials, and they were surprised to read about a request for proposals from the Massachusetts Maritime Academy regarding housing in the downtown. And so it sounds like maybe officials had heard a little bit about this, but didn't know it was actually concrete and actually going forward until they read about it somewhere, right?
Yeah, and this sounds like a kind of specific miscommunication versus a broader miscommunication, although there were some questions raised about the ongoing back and forth between the town and the academy, which is obviously a big part of the Buzzards Bay area. The academy had issued a request for information or proposals on February 23rd. looking to buy an acre lot along Main Street to provide 150 to 200 additional beds for the school. It's a school that's been doing fairly well recently, mm-hmm. and I think they have room for 1,400 students to be on campus right now, and there are 1,600, this is living on campus, and 1,600 are attending. They're expecting that number to go up to 1,800, so obviously they're looking to the future. But they had issued this request, and town officials, selectmen, and other town officials had essentially said, we didn't know this was coming. There had been a meeting about the school looking forward and thinking about expansion, but it hadn't specifically addressed the fact that they were going to issue this request, which is essentially something where they're looking for information from properties or owners of properties who might say, hey, you can use this property. The problem the town sees with this potentially is that it takes that property off the tax rolls because the school is a educational facility and is exempt from taxes in that way. And it also takes a potential piece of property on Main Street in Buzzards Bay, which has been a place where officials have been trying to get some action and look at some revitalization efforts for years now. It's been a long-running conversation there. And they're worried by taking that piece of land and putting it towards students living there that you may affect that effort. The school says, hey, listen, this was kind of just looking for information. This is part of a broader study that we're doing about housing for the school, and we weren't necessarily planning on acting on that information that we receive right away. And we'll try and stay more in touch. But also, we believe that if you did put students there, it might actually help with the revitalization effort. And you could see an argument there where young people being down there on Main Street and Buzzards Bay may be something that's a positive thing. So they've both said, hey, listen, we're gonna keep communicating and we're going to keep talking about this. And generally, the relationship is good, although one selectman said he saw it going backwards. So we'll see how this plays out. But obviously, there's probably going to be more phone calls and more meetings going forward on this effort.
Moving on to another story, whenever you talk about herbicides on Cape Cod, people get concerned because there's a sole source aquifer here, basically a pool of our fresh water, which we draw from, is sitting beneath us. And so when you talk about herbicides and there's the potential for it to seep down into the soil and perhaps the groundwater, that's the concern anyway. What's happening with the Herring River?
Yeah, and usually we're talking about Eversource and transmission lines in this instance, but people have pointed out, and Eversource has certainly pointed out, that it comes up in all sorts of situations, including out in the Cape Cod National Seashore. And the Herring River project out in the Wellfleet-Truro area sits in a lot of seashore land. A lot of it is within seashore land. And this project is a restoration project for the Herring River where they're trying to restore kind of historic tidal situation out there that was hampered by a dike that was put in 1909, I believe. But as part of that effort, there's been a question as to whether they were going to use herbicides because there's a lot of Phragmites, an invasive plant that's in the Herring River complex there. And herbicides have long been thought to be the best way to approach removing that plant. And so it was kind of on the list of things that would be done as part of this $50 million project. And there were people who said, we don't want that. Local citizens, I think there was a citizens group, it says, we don't want you using herbicides here. It's not good for the plants or other plants, and not good for potentially aquatic species. And so they've been pushing for it not to be used. And they seem to have won something here. A technical committee that's working on this project recommended that it not be part of these upcoming applications and permits that are being sought. And the project's executive council, again, how many different levels there are here, agreed on March 9th to accept that recommendation. So it's not going to be used in the Herring River project. This group is now pushing to say, hey, why don't you just eliminate it from being used in the seashore altogether? And it is used in different parts of the seashore. I think there's like, it doesn't sound like a lot, but like 13 gallons or so that's been used over the course of several years in the seashore in various locations and various applications. And so now they're pushing for this larger ban, and the Seashore Advisory Committee or Commission, I think, is going to take that up and start considering that.
Let's go to the phone. Jim Derude is joining us from the New Bedford Standard Times. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Jim, let's talk about the Acushnet River and the Superfund site there. So a new report to take a look at.
Yeah. In 2015, Boston University got a grant from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, and they looked at one of the worst Superfund sites in America for PCBs, which is up at the head of the Acushnet River, right near New Bedford and Acushnet. So, you know, it's been there 60 years. There was a settlement with the company that dumped the PCBs into the river a couple years ago for $366 million for the cleanup. So they were wondering if digging up these PCBs and moving them, or even if the contamination site itself was creating airborne contamination of PCBs. And the study found that although the levels of PCBs in the air aren't cause for harm, they are really high relative to other sites in all of North America. It's the worst site for PCBs in North America, although that the people that ran the study said you're not in danger because it's below the EPA levels. But they demonstrated that, indeed, being buried in the sediment all these decades, it's all coming up into the air and all drifting south from the point of contamination. 4.5 miles down south, they were able to measure it.
Wow. So if they're not concerned, it's just going to continue?
Well, as the cleanup continues, that will remove more and more of the source contamination. And part of that's being dewatered and shipped by rail, I think, out near the Great Lakes for disposal. But a lot of it that's at lower levels of contamination, they're putting them in these confined cells in the river. They dig down into the river, drop the contaminated sediment, and then cover it. This is a technique that's been used in other places, including right here in Narragansett Bay, right around just down the coast from us.
It's quite a story, but we need to move on to another one. Carlos Rafael, the fishing magnate, he was supposed to, I thought he was going to be pleading guilty this week to some federal charges, but it turns out now that's been postponed.
Yeah, postponed to the 30th of March. Very short story, just a procedural type of thing. U.S. Attorney's Office has no details on it, but they just asked to move it up farther.
And we don't. This is the gentleman who's known as the Codfather.
The Codfather, yes.
That's right. And so we don't know what any potential penalty would be here.
No.
And of course, the accusation comes down to mislabeling fish after they've been caught, right?
At a very, very big scale.
A very large scale, indeed. And briefly, I know that Governor Baker swung by the office this week. He was in town. What did the governor have to talk about?
Well, he stopped to see us just to keep us up to date on like his State of the Commonwealth. But he was in this area because he wanted to speak to vocational schools. And he went to a dinner at New Bedford, Greater New Bedford Vocational Technical, which is a regional school that includes Fairhaven and Dartmouth students as well. And there were superintendents from a dozen different VocTech schools there. And he talked a lot about getting more money to help the VocTech schools, that there's a program that he started in his first year that has spread about $30 million to 65 vocational schools, and he wants to bump that up by another $10 million this year. Mm. And he even expressed in the Ed Board with us, he expressed that if there are towns that realize that there's a vocational gap, he wants to see them come into the state for the school building authority money. That he's ready to get the SBA money into vocational schools.
Makes sense, especially in our region. I mean, those are the types of jobs that are available. We need those workers. Jim Deruta, the New Bedford Standard Times. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Sean.
And let's stay with the phone. I know Patrick Cassidy is waiting patiently here in the Woods Hole studio, but Ann Wood is joining us. She's waiting as well from the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Ann.
Hey, Sean. Hey, Patrick. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Yes. Hi, Ann.
Yes, two third-generation Irishmen sitting in the same studio right now, I imagine. And tell us about this CVS that's being proposed in Provincetown. Your note to me says people don't really want this, and now it seems, is the can being kicked down the road a little bit?
The can is being kicked down the road a little bit. We thought we had breaking news actually this morning and last night about the CVS. What happened was last week on Thursday, March 16th, CVS went in front of the planning board. It was basically triggered that it had to go in front of the planning board because the property that it's located, that it wants to be located on, has curb cuts that exceed 25% of the perimeter, which is not allowed in town. It has to have its own entrance and its own exit. So the TMC New England, who on behalf of Riley Brothers Realty, who wants to lease the property, part of the property to CVS and keep the rest of the giant parking lot, their attorney, who is Jamie Vieira, said that that's sort of meaningless because the curb cuts wouldn't really belong to CVS. They'd belong to the parking lot. Now, what happened during the course of the meeting was the Chamber of Commerce president, Patrick Patrick, ironically enough, on St. Patrick's Day, said that he wanted it referred to the Cape Cod Commission as a development of regional impact to go through that kind of review. The planning board seemed to agree on that, and they also wanted a traffic study, which Vieira didn't like either because he said the traffic study didn't really make sense because it would take into account cars that were driving through town and not necessarily going to the CVS. In the end, the planning board said, yes, it does need a traffic study, that CVS, they believe, would be a destination because the closest one is 27 miles away, and that it should be referred to the Cape Cod Commission, we thought. But now the town planner, Gloria McPherson, says that she's not actually sure that it's going to be referred to the Cape Cod Commission because there's some discrepancy between members of the planning board about whether they really referred it or they just wanted comments.
Oh. Now, if they refer it, that would mean the whole regulatory process in Provincetown comes to a halt until the commission makes a decision, right?
Exactly. So if they refer it and the commission looks at it, while it's looking at it, before it even decides to take it, everything in the town comes to a halt for the permitting process for the CVS. If it takes it, it goes to a halt until they make a decision. If they decide not to take it, then it goes back to the process. But the real thing for CVS here, the real thing the town can do to stop it, or the townspeople can do to stop it, is to go to a Zoning Board of Appeals meeting on April 6th, where they will talk about the formula business bylaw, which was created by town meeting in 2010 to keep formula businesses out of Provincetown. So if the ZBA decides to enact that, which it very well could because so many people just don't want chain stores here, yeah, citing that it could kill other businesses in town. We do have a lot of local business, mostly local businesses. The few chains that are here are grandfathered. So people just don't want it. They think it'll ruin the look of the town. They think it'll kill businesses here. And so we'll see what happens at the ZBA. But if it goes to the commission, yeah, the ZBA is going to be, that whole thing is going to be put on hold too.
And I've got just maybe 30 seconds here. Is that enough time to tell us about cruise ships in Provincetown?
Cruise ships in Provincetown, they're coming this year. We only had 3 last year. We have 21 this year. And the Pier Corps, which runs the pier for the town, is wanting to up the fees because the fees haven't been changed since the 90s, so that it'll be $1,000 berthing charge plus $250 or more per passenger, depending on the size of the boat. But it'll be interesting to see a lot of cruise ships in our small harbor this year.
All right. Look forward to it. Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, thank you.
Take care.
All right. You too. And let's take a quick break. When we come back, Patrick Cassidy's here from the Cape Cod Times. We'll also speak with Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Welcome back to the local news roundup here on WCAI and The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me is Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, this might be my favorite story of the week. There's a proposal for a new bathhouse at Mayflower Beach. And I looked at the headline. I saw that the figure is just over $1 million for this bathhouse. But then I read on and I saw maybe why.
Yeah, it's not just any bathhouse. This bathhouse has been designed, or this proposed bathhouse at this point has been designed to resemble the Mayflower, the pilgrim's ship, of course, that came to Cape Cod first and then on to Plymouth. And the type of ship that it, or it was a small ship, thankfully. The bathhouse has a couple of different components.
Would
that
the
make
bathhouse
it,
be bigger than the original Mayflower?
It may be. At $1 million, it certainly cost more than the original Mayflower.
That's true.
But it's supposed to be shaped like the ship in terms of when you look down on it from above, and there's a, I think it's going to be a steel or some sort of thing at the front that's supposed to look like a steering wheel for a ship, and there's a sail component in the middle of it, there's a concession stand, and there's to get to the practicalities of it, there's a number of stalls for obviously men and women, and more than is there now. And the issue is that the bathhouse there now, I think, failed a septic system test in 2015, and everybody agrees it needs to be replaced. The question now before town officials is whether or not you're going to replace it with something of this design and of this cost, and the finance committee in particular has raised concerns about the cost, asking why they didn't just design it the same way that they designed one for Corporation Beach that had previously been built.
$800,000 one.
Yeah, $825,000. More reasonable bathhouse price, apparently.
I guess.
But in any case, the answer was that this bathhouse needs to have enough stalls in it for the crowd at Mayflower, which is 300 parking spaces. So they said it needed to be bigger, essentially. And the beach director says, hey, I love the look of it. I'm about the practicality, though. I really do need this number of stalls, and I do need these facilities. You know, if the design doesn't make it through, he just wants to make sure that the function of the thing makes it through. But they'll be taking this up and looking at whether or not this is the right design going forward, and whether or not they're basically going to, I guess, approve the design. The fact is that the money from the beach fees goes to this project, not kind of general money. The finance committee says, hey, that's money that would maybe go somewhere else, and that's why they have concerns about it. But it's not as if it's money that's being raised separately from people going to the beach.
Yeah, your tax bill isn't going to go up over this, if it is approved, as you say. Yeah. Let's go to the phone with Barry Stringfellow, who is joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Times newsroom. Hello, Barry.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. You've been covering this Menemsha Dredge project for some time now, and you've talked about how it's been significantly delayed. Is the Army Corps of Engineers getting fed up? They going with somebody else?
Well, there's no contractor that's been chosen as yet, but they're definitely fed up. And the $2.2 million project that was supposed to dredge the channel that connects Menemsha Pond to Vineyard Sound that was supposed to take 3 months is going to take 3 years, hopefully. The Corps of Engineers terminated the contract with J-Way Southern, an Ohio-based company, based on a post-dredge survey that was conducted on February 13th. And in a stern letter, they said J-Way's failure to meet contract obligations is not excusable. Mm-hmm. And they went on to say also that J-Way has to have all their equipment off the location by March 21st, which is going to be quite a job because they have 2.5 miles of pipeline. They have pumps and bulldozers. They had to actually bring a lot of their equipment over on a private barge, so not sure how that's going to happen. But they were contracted to dredge 41,000 cubic yards of sand in 2015. And as of last count, it was about 19,000, so they're quite a way off. And they said the first year that they were delayed by weather and then the striped bass derby, and then a part broke, and then they had to stop on January 31st because of the permit by the DEP and DMF required the halt for the winter flounder migration. And they started again this past December. They had equipment problems again, and they asked for more days because of weather. The Army Corps granted them one, and it's just they had enough. So the pond is designated a harbor refuge, and it hasn't been dredged since the mid-70s. And right now, at a full moon low tide, a channel that's supposed to be 8 feet deep, the water barely comes up to your knees. So the other key element of this is that the sand from the dredge was being placed on Lobsterville Beach, and it was pristine sand, and it was working out beautifully when it did work. And Brett Stearns, the director of the Wampanoag Tribe Natural Resources Department, said that beach nourishment had actually saved Lobsterville Road. And he also said that the sand is likely to accrete over the winter, and this last storm certainly did some of that. So the total that was dredged is probably going to be less. But he said he's been assured by the Army Corps that the dredging will resume next fall.
Okay. Barry Stringfellow staying on the dredging project in Menemsha. Appreciate it very much, Barry. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Patrick Cassidy is here from the Cape Cod Times. And Patrick, voters in Falmouth will be looking at a room tax expansion.
Yes, and this isn't the only town that's asking for this, essentially. And this would expand the room tax beyond your typical hotels, motels, lodging houses, bed and breakfasts to include cottages, condominiums, apartments, single-family, multifamily homes that are rented for vacation stays of 90 days or fewer. And these aren't typically taxed at this point. And this has been a conversation that's come up in a number of other towns on the Cape, and there have been pushes to have the state legislature take these requests up from the towns and act on them and allow them to move forward with taxing these other types of accommodations. This really comes down to Airbnb-type rentals, and it's been a big thing not only here, statewide, nationwide, about how people are renting out basically parts of their home or their homes and not having it taxed as hotels and motels. And the thing that keeps coming up again and again is it's a attempt to level the playing field. That's the quote that a lot of people are using and say, if you're going to tax this facility and then this person is doing essentially the same thing, more or less, you want to tax them at the same rate. So Falmouth is pushing for this, and they have in the past approved a home rule petition. This is going to come before Falmouth town meeting, annual town meeting. They had approved a home rule petition asking for the same thing in 2015, and that's a special town meeting, actually, on April 4th, where they'll take it up again. If they do go forward with it, they'll join Provincetown, Truro, Wellfleet, and Brewster, who already have similar home rule petitions filed with the legislature. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing to me is when we've been doing these stories recently, there at least seems to be a general consensus that this is something that they should do to bring in more revenue to the towns and also, again, to make it more even in terms of how you're taxing all these facilities. I'm not sure where any pushback is, really, because I think even Airbnb has kind of agreed that this is something that they could do. And I heard a report the other day that said Airbnb may make out because they could help the people who are doing Airbnb with the tax situation and kind of offer them another service, which was kind of an interesting take on it. But the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce has said they're in favor of it. The president of the Falmouth Bed and Breakfast Association said his membership was all for it. So it's a little interesting. It's one of those things that goes to the legislature, and you kind of have to wonder why it hasn't been taken up there previous to this. I have a feeling that this year or next, it's probably going to win through in these towns, and they'll have it in place.
No real way to know how much revenue that might bring in, right?
No, we do have numbers in Falmouth, for example. It's not insubstantial, but in Falmouth, there are about 312 timeshare units and 7,200 seasonal single-family residents. That's a kind of the entire universe there. There are about 1,300 existing hotel units, so that gives you a comparison. But once you start taxing at 6% or more, which is, I think it's 5.7% to start that you would be doing it, you can start to see some real money come in. And the towns, and certainly Falmouth, with some of the issues that it's facing, I'm sure is looking for whatever revenue they can get. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Some decisions in the town of Eastham yesterday regarding two kind of longstanding proposals regarding affordable housing. One of them went forward. The other one didn't. Tell us about those.
Yeah, this was an interesting split decision in Eastham, which has been struggling for quite some time to get more affordable housing. They're the lowest percentage of affordable housing in their stock on the Cape compared to all the other Cape towns. At 1.9% of their stock is designated affordable. But these two projects have been kind of going through the process here. And one is the Governor Prince Residences, which is at the old Tea Time property. And that project has went before the ZBA, as well as the other project, the Campbell-Purcell project off Brackett Road the other night. And the ZBA rejected the Governor Prince Residences. And what it came down to is they said, They didn't like the attitude. They felt like the developer was basically disrespecting them in terms of not coming forward with more information than the bare minimum that he needed to. And they also didn't like the design. I think they referred to it as that it looked like barracks, basically, that he was looking to put up. It was these two large buildings. And so the ZBA rejected that project. It's unclear whether the developer, Richard Hayden, is going to appeal that rejection. The other project, Campbell Purcell, which is 65 apartments and 18 townhouse-style buildings, and we have a rendering on our website and in the paper today showing what it's supposed to look like. That project got a lot more positive feedback, and the ZBA approved it. If you have that project go forward, the percentage in the town of affordable stock would jump to 4.3%. And these are considered 40B projects because they do need some basically variances or dispensations to move forward, and they can only do that if they're 25% of the units there are affordable, and they would need ZBA approval to do that. And that 10% mark, which is kind of the standard in the state that you're supposed to reach before you have to kind of consider these 40B projects, still a ways off for East Ham if the Campbell Purcell project goes forward, but they're closer by a long stretch than they have been to hitting that mark. So again, we'll see. They still have to get financing, and they're looking at some state tax credits to finance the project. So
if they reach that 10%, then these 40B, so-called 40Bs, can't cruise as easily through
exactly
the approval process. Let's move on. We need to note the town administrator, longtime town administrator in the town of East Ham, is retiring, and she was the first town administrator.
Yep, and first and only town administrator in East Ham, Sheila Vanderhoff. And she's stepping down today. She may be clearing out the last few boxes as we speak. But she came on board in 1992, and that was the first time that East Ham actually had a town administrator. And reporter Casey Myers spent some time with her this week, and she looked back on that time, the last 25 years. Interestingly enough, she's one of three female town administrators on the Cape out of the 15 towns now. At the time, in 1992, she was one of three female town administrators on the Cape. So that percentage and the number of female town administrators hasn't changed. She is the only black town administrator on the Cape and has been during that whole time. She, in her conversation with Casey, expressed some surprise that hadn't changed, that there wasn't another black town administrator on the Cape during her time. But she also did say, listen, whenever I ran into a problem, you know, racism wasn't the first place I looked in terms of what the problem was. And she really pointed that out. She's had an interesting life and career. Mm-hmm. She's raised in the Chicago's West Side, spent 16 years in Canada, and then came to the Cape. And she worked in Dennis, I think, for a little while before becoming the town administrator in East Ham.
And she's been on our airwaves, obviously, and was really great to deal with. Let's move to this story about sharks. Everyone's ears are perking up. So now they're looking at perhaps using these kind of balloons, these large balloons, to track where sharks may be in terms of our beaches, right?
Yeah, they've been trying to figure out how to do this, and really visually is the only way that a lot of town officials consider that they could do this. People have talked about drones. They've talked about, in some places, I think like South Africa, you can get up on cliffs and have watchers looking for the sharks. And in this case, there's a company out of Florida, Altimetry Smart Balloon Company, and they have a large kind of weather-type looking balloon that they attach a camera to, and they would send that up into the air on a tether, essentially, and they would be able to look down on the beach. And so they've started considering testing that out here. I think this summer there's going to be a pilot project that shark scientist, state shark scientist Gregory Scomel is involved in at Shark Cove.
So right now they use planes when they can, but that it's expensive, it's only a short duration, is that right?
Well, the planes are really up there working with the researchers. They're not necessarily up there looking for sharks in order to protect the beachgoers, the swimmers. The idea here was that you'd have real-time information and you could tell swimmers to get out of the water if a shark comes close to the shore. I mean, the fact is right now there are sharks swimming very close to swimmers probably, and they just don't know it because they can't see it. With the numbers of sharks that are around the Cape that we've heard about, it's impossible that they're not out there and around swimmers. But this would give you at least some idea of whether they're getting closer to swimmers or not. And they say one of these balloons could, for instance, be up and looking at the whole protected area that's lifeguarded out in Nauset Beach, which is one of the areas that's kind of the primary concern. But again, there's a battery issue too. I think it's 5 or 6 hours for the battery, but they say we're working on a tether that could just run electricity right up to the camera, and you don't even have to worry about a battery.
Probably get a good view of that proposed Mayflower-shaped bathhouse.
Right from the sky, exactly.
Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times, thanks for coming in on St. Patrick's Day.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay, we spoke with Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joined us. Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times was on the phone, as was Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner. And, of course, Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times spoke with us as well. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.
The Friday News Roundup is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.